Now, the chances are that you caught sight of our next guest on your TV screens. He frequently appears, as one British newspaper puts it, staring out to sea, his luscious hair streaming in the wind like a Scottish Paul Dark. Archaeologist, historian, author and presenter Neil Oliver has presented some of the BBC's biggest landmark TV series, such as Coast, Vikings and A History of Scotland, vividly bringing ancient worlds back to life. The people, history and geography always inextricably intertwined with nature.
Constructing a property on an island with only limited access to the mainland would present builders with a few headaches, even today. But imagine trying to build a house 14 miles out at sea 300 years ago. A house that would be responsible for saving thousands of lives.
Neil Oliver is undoubtedly a man with itchy feet during his hugely popular TV series. He's lapped the coast of Britain and Ireland more times than he can remember, as well as venturing further afield to Scandinavia, France, North America, Australia and New Zealand. But as the saying goes, home is where the heart is, especially for this Renfrew-born man who's now president of Scotland's National Trust. On a recent visit to Ireland, when he was speaking at the Imrama Festival of Travel Writing in Lismore, County Waterford, Neil stopped off and joined Richard Collins for a brief, wet and windy walk along Dublin's coast.
Neil, I couldn't resist the temptation to bring you to Howth, because this wonderful harbour here was created by a Scottish engineer, John Rennie, if you please imagine that. And the harbour on the far side, the rival harbour, the far side of Dublin, Dunleary, was also his work. So you were in a kind of a Scottish enclave or promontory from home. You were famous on our screens across for many things, a history of the Celts, for instance, and Coast, of course. And this programme, Coast, is extraordinary. You began life as an archaeologist, is that right?
I did. I studied for a degree in archaeology at Glasgow University in the mid-80s. And then life took me on a strange and unexpected path. I retrained as a newspaper reporter. I worked as an internet journalist and then accidentally stumbled into television in my early 30s. And then Coast came along. It was a happy accident, but it was a wonderful accident. It put me aboard a magic carpet, really, that then carried me on a journey, a bespoke tour of the islands of Britain and Ireland. I've seen so many places that even locals would not have visited. You bringing me here, telling me something that I don't know about the fact that this is the work of a Scottish engineer, that is, in the best possible sense, the story of my coast life. We were very much in the role of learning things on behalf of the viewers. We weren't supposed to be experts, we weren't supposed to be any kinds of know-it-alls. We would turn up, we would meet interesting people and hear and learn just moments before the viewers did. And I think that was part of what made the programme attractive, because it gave it a kind of immediacy. And then we'd be discovering something about local wildlife, local plant life, whales, seals, seabirds. It was a constant, constantly changing and evolving cornucopia, which made it fascinating. And I think that was why, it lasted for 10 years. It was so popular with viewers, because it was constantly refreshing itself, much like the sea does.
So you're a kind of polymath, a kind of Renaissance man of modern archaeology, science and history.
I wouldn't make any such claim. I was in the very privileged position of constantly being exposed to people who were. I've had a unique experience of learning from, listening to and acquiring some scraps of knowledge from experts all the way along the line, which has given me a very strange collection of information that now rattles around inside my head.
Well, now, when you look back at that long series, 10 years, you say, are there particular ones that stand out? What comes into your mind? What is the most life-changing interview you did or experience you had on that? Or is that too difficult a question?
Life-changing is difficult. I can honestly say, I mean, here I've been around and around the island of Ireland many times, the North and the Republic. And I do remember feeling very strongly that I had never experienced the Atlantic Ocean anything like as powerfully as I did when I was on the western coast of the Aran Islands. You know, to stand on the western coast of Inishmore and look out at that muscle of the Atlantic when it's coming in, the waves having not struck land for whatever it is, 2,500 miles since North America, that the Atlantic only looks like that in one place, and it's right there. So I was very struck by the west coast of Ireland, Galway, Aran Islands. But in terms of life-changing experiences, the whole thing was a life-changing experience. It was just an enormous privilege to see so many places. It's why I wrote the book. I'm here at the Imrama Festival because I'm talking about a book I published last year called The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places. I know that the use of the word British there is controversial, but it's a cartographer's convention to name an archipelago after the largest landmass. But there are stories about... there are Irish stories there as well as stories from every other country in the archipelago, these islands. And I feel as if I've just been given a unique tour, and I can honestly say that the experience of doing the kind of work that I've done has blurred national boundaries for me. Time and time again, we crossed boundaries between Ireland and Northern Ireland, between England and Wales, England and Scotland, and going round and around and around, I lost track of national boundaries and national identities, and the whole place became one archipelago with which I fell in love. And I regard myself as being a citizen of the whole place. You know, I'm standing here, in the outskirts of Dublin, and I feel as much a sense of, fondness, love, responsibility for this landscape as I do for landscapes back home in Scotland or in England or in Wales. I feel a sense of belonging to the whole place.
So these boundaries are really only in the mind. If you're interested in nature or ecology, you don't think in these terms. I never sort of think at all about boundaries, political boundaries. They don't mean anything. I remember your programme, Orkney, the capital of Britain or something
yes.
like that. Now, in that, you linked very much the Irish megalithic remains with those of Scotland. And I presented a kind of unified view of things. You seem to have got the impression that Newgrange was a sort of central location from which the others sprung out. Would you outline a bit of that for us?
Yes. Newgrange and Nowth are dated to, I think, 3,200. They're older than the pyramids. Mm-hmm. They're amongst the oldest architecture of their kind anywhere. Mm-hmm. And clearly there was a cosmology, a way of understanding life and the universe and everything that surrounds it that inspired people to circular creations. And, you know, and obviously Newgrange and others of those mounds are circular. They functioned as much more than burial places. They were probably much more akin to the idea of a cathedral. You know, you don't just go to a church because of death. You go for many... Through the cycle of the year, you go for births and you go for marriages, and there are other celebrations besides. And those buildings, those structures, probably functioned in similar ways, encyclopedic ways. And yes, there are similarities across the board. You know, there was obviously contact between Ireland and the Long Island of the United Kingdom. Architects are obviously moving between them. There's no doubt about it that there was commonality. And if you could call it a religion, or perhaps it was a science, that people understood it right across this archipelago. I have had so many experiences, though, around the Irish island. I was hugely affected by a few stories that I did across the course of just a few days, where I learned about the Angorta Mór, I think it's described, the Great Hunger, and also the fact that not only had there been the Great Hunger, there was slavery, that a place like Baltimore was hollowed out by Barbary pirates. And those slavery and starvation, those are maladies of humankind that we associate with, say, Africa in the modern era. And I found it enormously affecting to realise that here people were affected by exactly the same curses. And then later the same day, I went out in a towel sail yawl, this beautifully refurbished wooden vessel, and we sailed out to Fastnet, to the teardrop of Ireland. And I was so moved by the fact that you don't have to travel too far. You don't have to take too great a journey to experience so much of the human condition. You know, who would have thought that you could go to one corner of a relatively small island like Ireland and see the curses of famine and starvation and disease and slavery, and then the grief of the emigrants, those that had no option, they felt, but to leave this homeland and go elsewhere. And it was all, you know, in a patch of ground that I covered in the course of a couple of days. And it was I've remembered that week ever since.
Of course, we think of M1s and M6s and all, and M25s and M50s and all this sort of thing, because we think that's the way one travels. But of course, back in the time of the Neolithic people, it was the sea and rivers that connected people. And of course, back then, Newgrange is not all that far from Orkney, say, when you go by sea. If you had to go by land, it's something else. So in a sense, it's not surprising that you have the Cager Fields right on the coast, and you have the Boyne Valley, Tumuli and so forth, and you have all the wonderful megalithic remains in Scotland, and indeed down into France, Karnak, and some in Spain even. So there's a kind of link all the way from Africa, really, North Africa, all the way up to the north of Scotland. So in a funny sort of way, the map you must have in your head, of ancient times, is rather different, you know, from what you would find if you bought a map out of the shop.
You know, we've touched already on this experience that I've had where modern national boundaries blur. And I think it's not just an experience that only I would have. I think anyone who travels around the way I have, and I think perhaps the way you have, you lose track of where you are in relation to modern distinction. It becomes a landscape. And yes, there are divisions and there are lines, but they're not those lines. Or there are other lines that are older and that tell a different story. But you know, the Cager Fields that you mentioned, that was an extraordinary story. That was a farmer called Patrick Caulfield discovered a piece of dressed stone while doing some or other work on some of his land, thought nothing more about it, and then it was his son Seamus who became the archaeologist who then persevered and has mapped mile upon mile of cattle enclosure that Neolithic farmers had built, some kind of massive community collective effort to create this whole a landscape shape for looking after cattle. Fields to keep cows separate from bulls, cows and calves separate from the rest of the herd. You know, they were managing livestock on a grand scale, and all of that revealed by the efforts of one man until relatively recent times. So you have to come to somewhere like the Cager Fields to see something that was presumably the case right across the landscape, and in Scotland, and in England, and we've lost it there because of, you know, more modern development. But that little glimpse that you get in the Cager Fields would probably have just been a stand-in for what would have been normal in the rest of the landscape.
And I'm sure you drove a pole into the ground, and it touched a stone a few metres down.
It's magical. It's a magical
And that
feeling.
Was not touched by anyone for 5,000 years.
And the fact that it's an iron rod, and you push them, you know, feet down. I mean, the blanket bog there is anything up to 15 feet thick. And you push down, and then you hear this, it's like ringing a bell. You hear this ting, 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 ting of the iron on the stone. And you think, you know, you're making that stone speak that has been silent and asleep under the blanket bog for thousands of years, and it's a magical experience.
And I remember you describing somewhere, or maybe you wrote it, holding a tool of a Stone Age man in your hand and thinking, well, the last person who held this died billions ago, and how you, there's a connection with them. He's same as you biologically.
I think it's unavoidable to feel that sense of connection. There's a wonderful a mace head that came out of the burial mound at Nowth. It's about the size of a man's clenched fist, and the way it's been worked, it's a piece of Orkney flint actually, but by some or other path it has found its way to that part of Ireland, and it's been worked beautifully so that when you look at it, it looks like a face. It's like two eyes and a mouth wide open, and the shaft of the handle would have fitted into what is effectively the gaping maw of this stylized face. And you, I've held it in my hand, and you have to wonder at the, you know, that you're holding a work of art. And other people have held it, but not so many in the intervening millennia. But you're making some sort of connection with someone who sat and looked at a beach pebble and thought, what can I make of that? And their artistic genius and their and their energies went into it and transformed it into what you're now holding in your hand. And it's impossible to avoid, I think, feeling some sort of connection to that person across the abyss of time.
So, Neil, you are a man in passage. Everywhere you're going somewhere, and mentally and physically, and I think spiritually even, you are going places all the time. Hopefully, you will come back to Ireland one day, and you will be a changed man even then from what you are now.
I expect always to be back. I travel, I go back to places repeatedly. I've lost track now of how many times I've been on Orkney. I've lost track of how many times I've been on Shetland. I've lost track of how many times I've been in Cornwall or Cambridgeshire or of how many times I've been in the Welsh Valleys, how many times I've been in Northern Ireland, how many times I've been in the Republic of Ireland. And I'm always thinking, well, when I leave, every time I think, well, I'll be back.
Neil, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thank you very much indeed.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard Collins and Neil Oliver.